Here Be Monsters is a show that invites you to explore fear and the unknown.
I saw her face change. I saw her see where I'd pulled my hair out.
Psychological warfare was always considered kind of an oddity, something done by freaks.
On the count of three, we're literally going to step out of our body. Step out.
You can find Here Be Monsters now at kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. Is Pereira in peril? Los Angeles architect William Pereira's work is getting renewed interest as some of his buildings are set to be torn down. And we'll talk to Tracy Tynan, a costume designer in LA who used clothing to find meaning during a chaotic childhood.
In some ways, you can say, oh, clothing's just superficial, who cares? But on another level, I think it does tie into how we feel about ourselves.
We'll hear about Tynan's memoir, Wear and Tear, The Threads of My Life. But first, if you're driving along Sunset Boulevard just west of downtown, you may spot a very cool-looking apartment building. It's called the Elysian. It's a very sleek, retrofitted 1970s modernist tower. The developer behind the project is Yuval Bar-Zema. His company, Linear City, has turned many older buildings in downtown's Arts District and Hollywood into residences. He talked to DNA's Avishai Artsy.
The building was in terrible shape. It was vandalized. It was sitting empty for probably over a decade. Had no roof, so there was significant water damage. The entire interior of the building was gutted and a lot of graffiti and vandalism.
But you were interested in it because it's a William Pereira building?
Yeah, this is really a gem. It's a marvel of one of the best architects of Southern California. For me, it's like a trophy project, meaning that this architect was one of three architects in history to be on the cover of Times Magazine with I.M. Pei and Frank Lloyd Wright. So good company.
William Pereira is a mid-century Los Angeles architect, and this 70s tower was a later addition to a lower-rise building he designed in 1963. Since 1996, that building has contained a Korean church, but it was originally built as the headquarters for the Metropolitan Water District. Here's Alan Hess, architecture historian.
It is one of the two great monuments to water architecturally in Los Angeles. In fact, from here you can see the Department of Water and Power over on Bunker Hill.
And designed by A.C. Martin.
Designed by A.C. Martin and William Pereira. These were two of the biggest firms in Los Angeles. And not only just big firms, but important firms. They were defining Los Angeles, Southern California, at a point in history when Southern California was booming. It was exploding. And it was becoming to have a sense of itself on the world stage. That suddenly in the 1950s and 1960s, Los Angeles becomes this center of industry, aerospace, high tech, movies, music, entertainment, etc., and architecture. And these architects, these big architects, William Pereira, A.C. Martin, Welton Becket, Victor Gruen, and others, realized they had a mission, not just to build buildings for these new corporations and these new civic institutions, but to make a proclamation about what Southern California was all about. And in my opinion, the Metropolitan Water District here is a key building in Pereira's evolving definition of what modern architecture in the New Age was all about.
Which was?
Well, first of all, what wasn't it? It was not Bauhaus. It was not plain glass curtain walls. That was old modernism, been around since the teens and 20s. Here in Southern California, arguably the most modern city in the world at that time, most progressive, looking to the future, they wanted modernism, functionality, structural expression, but in an entirely new way.
Particular features that express that, what would they be?
One of the main elements you can see are these twin structural columns that march down the sides of the building. These are tapered, they go up into the sky. In fact, they even go above the roof line so that they create a silhouette against the sky. But then functionally, you have these pairs of columns on either side with a very heavy concrete beam between, which means that all of the office space in these buildings have no columns. Completely open, free plan, much more flexible, much more functional, much more modern. Easier to warm up to for the average person.
That's Alan Hess, architect and historian. The retrofitted tower has a fancy restaurant on the ground floor called Winsome and now stands as a beacon of a fast-changing neighbourhood between Chinatown and Echo Park that was once referred to as the Forgotten Edge. Now, this is bad news for people seeking affordable homes, to be sure, but good news for lovers of LA modern architecture. Except that the lower-rise part of the complex faces a different story. It currently sits in a forlorn state. Balcony railings have been stripped away. Rebar in concrete floors now sticks out. The owner of the 5.3-acre site is a development company named Palisades Capital Partners. They say the building has been altered beyond repair and they plan to demolish it. But local architecture preservationists are trying to halt the proceedings by getting the building a landmark designation. The application has been filed by Yuval Barzema, and last week he sparred with the developer's preservation consultant, Jenna Snow, on a tour of the building that was held by the LA County's Cultural Heritage Commission.
This was the main public interior space, and the church initially used it as their sanctuary but outgrew it. This is a photo taken by Julie Schulman shortly after it opened, and some of the finishes and features seen in this photograph were removed by the church. And as you can see, there is no longer any historic finishes or features.
I'm actually shocked to find that actually the skeleton of room is intact with the oval shape. And if you look carefully, you see that they actually left in place the storefront system and just drywalled behind it. So this would be actually relatively an easy restoration exercise.
Now, Palisades Capital Partners says that if the building gets a historic designation, they will work in a transparent way to meet the needs of the commission and the local community. So why are they not interested in adapting a cool modernist building just like Barzema did? Because, says VP of Development Brian Falls, not only is the building no longer intact, but more importantly, he says it represents its period in a way that did not actually benefit the lives of residents.
Urbanistically, the site is about 30 feet above sunset. The building was built during a time where it was basically isolated up on a hill, and it was accessed completely by cars. We've always put an emphasis on pedestrian transit connectivity to the site. And with the 30-foot grade separation, you'll never be able to achieve that by keeping the existing buildings.
Falls says his company cares deeply about great urban design, and their portfolio includes 8600 Wilshire. That's a mixed residential and commercial complex in Beverly Hills designed by prominent Chinese firm MAD Architects, and that'll be the firm's first U.S. project. Now back to the MWD building and William Pereira. He also built the theme building at LAX, CBS Television City, the Transamerica Pyramid in San Francisco, and he master planned the city of Irvine. Back to historian Alan Hess.
The thing was, he was very successful, very popular in the main part of his career, but his reputation took a nosedive in the late 60s, 70s, and he finally passed away in the 1980s. He was considered a
commercial
architect. Yeah, he was so much more. And it has taken us several decades to understand that.
But not everyone loves all Pereira's work. One of his other projects that currently faces demolition is the complex of three original buildings at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. Even when it was completed in 1965, many critics hated it. Arts and Architecture magazine called the result egregious, while the Saturday Review found it insensitive, even structurally obtuse. The total impact, they said, is singularly oppressive. Alan Hess, however, believes the building was perfect for its time. He says the problem was what came next.
Well, many mistakes were made at LACMA over the years. The building of the Anderson wing, for example, by Hardy Holzman Pfeiffer, which destroyed the relationship of the buildings to Wilshire and to the terraces, the sculpture terraces and the water features that were originally planned there. So it isn't all there, but I think enough is there that really the sensible solution is to do an adaptive reuse and additions to LACMA.
That was architecture historian Alan Hess. He's working on a book about California modernism from 1900 to 1975. Now, LACMA's director, its board, and the County Board of Supervisors do not support an adaptive reuse. They say Pereira's buildings are altered beyond repair and do not serve the museum's needs. Instead, they're pushing to start construction in 2018 of an entirely new building designed by renowned Swiss architect Peter Zumthor. While on the tour of the Metropolitan Water District building, we met up with Greg Golden. He's an architecture critic and he's a member of the Miracle Mile Residents Association, which represents folks who live near LACMA. Greg is among those interested in a public scoping meeting that will be held Wednesday night at the BCAM building at LACMA. At this meeting, they will gather the so-called scope of the next stage of the building process, the Environmental Impact Report, or EIR. At the meeting, you can pose the questions about the project you would like to have answered in this EIR. Here's Greg Golden.
A scoping meeting and what will follow the Environmental Impact Report are both extremely limited in the questions you can ask. So I might not ask any questions at that meeting that ultimately have bearing on where the Peter Zumthor design and the Michael Govan plan for LACMA are going, because we're not going to be able to address aesthetic issues. We're not going to be able to address economic and fiscal issues. We're not going to be able to address matters of how does the building actually impact the neighborhood? How does it affect the surrounding park? None of those questions are on the table.
So what questions are on the table?
Whether or not the building, when they build it, will produce more or less
traffic.
Traffic, smog, impacts of that kind. The problem here is it doesn't go to the core of what's wrong with the plan as we know it.
That leads me to presume that you think there are things that are wrong with the plan and the design as we know it.
I do. But it begins with, we don't know very much about this plan at all. It's just an article of faith. The director of LACMA, Michael Govan, who's a very charming, likable, and I think his ambitions have been great for the museum, he wants to build a monument. And the way he wants to build it is to ask everybody in the public to simply take it as an article of faith that he's hired the best architect for the job. The building is a total cipher.
There are renderings of this cipher, however, and the renderings suggest somewhat of a monolithic structure that extends across Wilshire. And we're not talking about a slender little bridge that's extending across Wilshire.
Yes, that we think we know. We know it's flat. We know it's elevated anywhere from 20 to 30 feet above the roadway. That much we do know. If you look at the plot plan, the drawings, the only drawing that has been released shows this building plotted on the site. It's 200 feet long by 120 feet wide, which is the width of Wilshire Boulevard. That's not an incidental little breezeway or walkway crossing over a boulevard. That is a major intervention on a designated scenic highway. And that's not good. These kinds of structures disrupt the fabric of a city hugely. It will also impose itself because it scales up to it tops out at 74 feet high. Added to which, not only will it be doing that at the boulevard, it'll be doing it on both sides, one side on the park and the other side across the street. So suddenly what you will have is a huge dark object that has just landed right there. How much that can be weighed through the scoping meeting or the environmental impact report, we really don't know. And we have no say.
We asked LACMA director Michael Govan what the EIR will consider.
The EIR will definitely, it's not even a question, study the impacts on the neighborhood, including scenic resources, visual character and quality, shading impacts, traffic, emergency response and evacuation.
That was Michael Govan. Greg Golden also has concerns with the taxpayer contribution to the project. The financing plan for the museum involves a municipal bond of $125 million and a second bond issue totaling $300 million for completion, which LACMA has committed to pay over 30 years.
That's taxation without representation. It's the papacy, it's the Pope directing Michelangelo to keep painting, but we don't know what the guy is putting up there on that ceiling.
Now, of course, Michelangelo stunned his papal clients and generations to come with the Sistine Chapel in the Vatican in Rome that he had worked on in isolation for 4 years. Now, could the Zumtor design have the same impact on Los Angeles? We reached out to architect Frank Escher. He has been a vocal proponent of the design.
I do believe that a lot of people who are now very critical or have reservations or have concerns will be completely surprised when they see the final building. The completed building will really be a knockout. It will give Los Angeles a very new sort of dimension in terms of public architecture. One of the biggest points of contention, I guess, is the idea of crossing Wilshire Boulevard. And I have to be perfectly honest with you, it took me a while to like that idea, because I, in a way, liked the original design better. That was just sort of this object or cloud floating inside the park. But the idea that this building will occupy a very, very visible place in the city, I think, is very exciting. I mean, an institution like LACMA, one of the most important encyclopedic museums in the western part of the United States, should have a very visible place in our city. And by placing it over Wilshire Boulevard, it will have that.
That's architect Frank Escher. The scoping meeting for LACMA's new design takes place at 6 p.m. Wednesday night. See our website for details. You're listening to DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. Coming up after this break, a costume designer talks about how clothes gave meaning to a lonely childhood amidst literary aristocracy.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. Fashion is often dismissed as superficial, but can clothing also function as a source of comfort and even empowerment? That's a theme that is woven through Tracy Tynan's new memoir, Wear and Tear, The Threads of My Life. Tynan is an LA-based costume designer and writer. She was raised in London and New York in the 1950s and 60s as the only child of two famously fashionable and degenerate figures, the theatre critic Kenneth Tynan and the novelist and biographer Elaine Dundie. She recalls that when they weren't writing with sparkling wit, they were fighting, drinking and having affairs that culminated in divorce. Her father developed a fondness for S&M while her mother drank herself into rehab. And behind the swirl of her parents' bohemian and literary life lay loneliness and chaos from which clothing served as a refuge.
My father, I think from an early age, was kind of quite a unique character. And he was very much doted on by his mother and encouraged in all his various interests. And he had a passion for clothing. And when eventually he went to Oxford, he was famous for his outlandish clothing, which included a suit made out of billiard table cloth and another one made in a sort of dove gray color. And he was kind of well-known character around Oxford.
So he was a big dandy. He was, you know, this is the man that went on to write O Calcutta. He became extremely famous at that time when one critic could shut down a play. But
His wife too, Elaine, she's also quite the dresser, and you have a front cover image that shows the two of them gazing at each other, presumably somewhat lovingly at that time, dressed for effect.
It was taken in 1958, and they are both wearing leopard pants and white shirts, and they're sitting on a faux zebra skin sofa. And behind them is the Hieronymus Bosch Garden of Earthly Delights, which was on our living room wall, blown up huge. So they definitely were very flashy. And this photo actually comes from a piece that the Daily Mail Interiors did. So it's kind of interesting view of what their flat looked like at that time.
So they're living this life of dandyism and parties and writing. They're part of the literary set. They know all the actors. And there's you, little Tracy, whose childhood seems to have been one of utter neglect by those parents.
Yes, I think, you know, they did the best they could. Basically, they were on a different schedule than I was. So they would be going out at night to the theater and to dinner, and then they would sleep during the day. Meanwhile, as a child, I was awake during the day and sleeping at night. So that was part of the issue, is our paths didn't really cross that much.
So there you were living in this milieu, which in retrospect, of course, seems immensely glamorous. But you're a child in that milieu. Your book is about that life, but also it's a story that's told through clothes. Tell us about that piece of it.
Well, for me, appearances were very important to my parents. They had all these glamorous friends who looked glamorous, acted glamorous. So I was very aware of that, that looks mattered. And I guess the thing that I latched onto was how people dressed. And I was interested in that. And it was ever changing with this cast of incredible people, you know. And so I took an interest in that. And also, I think as I grew, I began to understand that for me, because I was quite shy, I could put on a dress or put on something and it would be a way to show myself.
But let's start when you're 6 years old and your parents bring you a really strange present from a vacation there, from a trip they go on.
Well, my parents came back from Spain, where they often went because my father was a big bullfighter aficionado. And my mother handed me a box, and inside the box was a pair of lemon yellow underpants and a pair of lime green underpants. And they were frilly and they were nylon. And I thought this was so peculiar. I really wanted to stuffed animal or a doll. But I don't know why she thought this would appeal to me, but she gave them to me. And I kind of didn't know quite what to do with them. And then one day when I was out with my friends, I wore them. We'd gone to the circus. And when we came back, for some reason, it was kind of unlike me, I decided as their car drove off to moon them. And I lowered my underpants. And my father happened to catch this, and he was sort of slightly appalled. And then I realized I'd done something terribly wrong. And in this weird way, I blamed it on the underpants, like the underpants made me do it. And then I felt that I had to sort of get rid of those underpants. They had a bad mojo.
So again, you take refuge in clothing. It's through clothes that you really develop confidence and establish a strong personality. For example, the story of the apple green shoes.
That came about because my mother and I would go shopping together for clothing. And I always knew what I wanted, and I wouldn't stop until I found it. And this drove my mother insane.
And you were young at this time.
I was like 12, 13. And finally, after one of these expeditions where she was kind of tearing her hair out and why can't you just take that sweater? Why do we have to keep looking for the perfect color kind of thing? She said, okay, I'm going to give you a clothing allowance and this will solve the problem. And I was thrilled. And I needed some shoes and I went off to find shoes. And I found these fantastic shoes in my view. They were apple green. They weren't exactly shoes that would go with everything, but I thought they were brilliant. But they were expensive and I would expend on them basically, you know, half my clothing allowance for the year. And so I didn't do an impulse buy. I did return back to our flat in London and think about it overnight and decided, no, I had to have these shoes. So I bought them, and that was kind of a liberating moment. I had control over my life. I could choose the shoes that I walked in.
So that leads us into your adulthood, and eventually you form a career around clothes. Tell us about that.
Well, that happened somewhat accidentally. I married a film director, Jim McBride, and he was doing this film Breathless. And he had a costume designer that he was working with, who was an incredibly talented guy, Alan Heifel, but they just weren't communicating. And he would come home at night and he would sort of complain to me and say, I don't know what I'm doing wrong or whatever. And I would offer suggestions. And so he said, well, I know, I'm going to put you on as Alan's assistant and maybe things can work out. And luckily for me, Alan was an incredibly generous guy, and I think he was feeling frustrated with dealing with my husband. So I became a kind of go-between, and it was a fantastically wonderful learning experience.
So out of that, you become a costume designer. That becomes your career, and you've worked on major films, including some of your husband's, as well as other directors. And so in the book, you do talk about that, I guess... There's clothing you wear through which you make your own statement, and then there's clothing that tells the story of a character in a film, which is a different task.
Yes, it is. And I think people often don't quite understand that. In, you know, I think with so much going on with labels and styling, that in a film as a costume designer, when you break down the script and you're looking at the characters and you're looking at the kind of place they live and how much money they earn and what could they afford and what how they might want to present themselves to the world. I studied social anthropology at Sussex University, and it is a kind of anthropology that goes on.
So as we draw to the end of your life, your children have grown up, and you and Jim have moved to downtown. You're
yes.
part of the new hipster set in downtown, but obviously there's many, many homeless people living in downtown, and you become very aware of that. So you decide to apply your costume designer skills in that direction. Tell us about that.
Well, I was very, very fortunate to hook up with two women who started this project called the Glamour Project. We go to various homeless centers and rehabs, and one of the women, Cara Fox, is a photographer, and Evie Shapiro, who's a therapist, but she does makeup. And we also have hats and scarves and jewelry. And so I do the styling. So what we do, it's like these ladies are queen for a day. And so they get makeup, they get styled, then they're photographed by Cara. And then a couple of weeks later, they get this glamour shot of themselves. And it's really a wonderful experience. A lot of the women have never had makeup, or they haven't been taking care of their appearance for a long time. And I think it's very empowering for them to see themselves in a different way. Often they tell us they're going to send these photos to relatives who they haven't spoken or seen for a long time. Another woman who's a social worker downtown says that sometimes when these women do eventually get homes, they put these portraits up in their homes, you know, to kind of show how far they've come. And we've worked with veterans. We've worked with women from all, you know, stripes of life. So in some ways, you can say, oh, clothing's just superficial, who cares? But on another level, I think it does tie into how we feel about ourselves.
That was Tracy Tynan. Her memoir is Wear and Tear, The Threads of My Life. She's also a well-established costume designer whose credits include Breathless, The Big Easy, Tuesdays with Maury, and many more. She will sign copies of the book at Samuel French Film and Theatre Bookshop on Sunset Boulevard on September 10th. And she will co-host with her husband, Jim McBride, a book party at the Last Bookstore in downtown Los Angeles in October. See our website for details. I'm Frances Anderton. That's it for today's DNA. Avishai Artsy is the show's producer. Ray Guana mixed this episode. Special thanks to Jason Groman and Stephanie Case. Thank you very much for listening.